Sure. So, okay, so good morning, everybody, and happy to be back, resuming this study. I believe we are in the paragraph, but neither is the separate cognition of them entirely an illusion or a complete error of the ignorance. Can you tell me what page that is, Shyam? Okay, so it's page 331, and at this point in this chapter, Indeterminates and Cosmic Determinations, if we look immediately behind, I mean before, we find that Sri Aurobindo is talking about how differences arise within the reality. And of course, the origin of this discussion goes back to asking the questions regarding how it is that we experience reality in terms of thoughts, in terms of being and its opposites. So there, in that earlier part, just before this period, he talks about how where we can take this entire distinction between the observer and the observed. Where does it arise? Where does the where what is the origin? And he takes us from an entire long consideration of the history of Western thought to the history of Indian thought, where we have to look towards extraordinary experiences to probe this question. And there he brings us into contact with the tradition of silencing the mind and observing the thoughts so that we can see that we are not the thoughts. And that's where the Eastern and Western traditions part company, or at least the rationalistic tradition of the West parts company with the long history of Indian metaphysics. From that point, he still probes further by asking the question that there are two problems that arise when we find that we are not the thinker, but thoughts occur to us. And that is, where do these thoughts come from? Are they illusions? Are they arising out of some depth of our own being, a sort of like a transcendence within our immanent existence? Are they coming from some transcendence outside us, a cosmic being of which we are only a part, or something even further, a transcendent being? So with this question, he takes us into the overmind, a cosmic existence, a cosmic consciousness. And he points to the fact that even here, some kind of a dichotomy exists, that we can experience a cosmic being, a cosmic existence, within which cosmic activity are taking place, and these are becoming individualized in us. So this distinction between the observer and the observed, the thinker and the thought, the experiencer and the experienced, the subject and the object remain even at the level of the overmind or the cosmic consciousness, as he calls it. Then he asks the question as to whether there is something even further where the two are one. And this is where he takes us beyond into the supermind. Now this train of thought is also following the Vedantic distinction between vidya and avidya, or knowledge and ignorance. I think somebody has their. Yeah, whoever was on has turned it off, I suppose. So the distinction between vidya and avidya in Vedanta, where in the vidya there is a new dimension, or rather that is the original dimension. We should rather say that in the avidya there is the removal of a dimension which is present in the vidya. And as a result of that, the experience in the avidya is one in which duality occurs. We could even rephrase that by saying that duality is the mode by which avidya is produced. So a certain form of will within the vidya, within the one, within the absolute, produces dualities, or as Sri Aurobindo points out a few paragraphs before this, actually produces trinities or triads. The trinity occurs because whenever there is a duality, there is a relationship between the two. So that produces a three. So that's where we notice that these trinities create a relational cosmos, a relational manifestation. And perhaps from a certain point of view, the objective of creating a relational cosmos or manifestation is one of the reasons or meanings of having a cosmos in the avidya as we experience it. Now that is not the only meaning of the avidya, only sense of the avidya. The sense of the avidya is also marked by struggle. Of course, we can call struggle a form of relationship. It is definitely a form of relationship. So these dualities which generate relationships also take on a certain different forms, and one of those forms is the form of struggle. The form of struggle arises from relationships between dualities that are opposed. So the beginning of this foundation, or the foundation of the avidya, is based on the creation of dualities and dualities that are opposed. The first such duality is that of something which is free, unconstrained, true, fully conscious and infinite, and its other, which seems to be inconscient, limited, fragmented, and in a state of sleep. That is what we may call the inconscient. So the two poles of spirit and the inconscient and its manifestation in matter are what draw out the spectrum of this cosmic existence, which is what we call the avidya. So a couple of things arises from that. Of course, this fact of relationship and the fact of duality, in other words of struggle, are the primary attributes of such an existence. But within that, what we find is that there is a will, a primary will, and along with it a number of subsidiary wills that maintain in a dynamic fashion the distinction between these forms of existence, these opposed and graded forms of existence. So we may say that not only are there two, but there is a infinite series of gradations between the two. And these infinite series of gradations can be then clubbed into smaller finite numbers. And this appearance of the finite is the third very important attribute of the avidya. The appearance of the finite out of the infinite, the maintenance of separation through will, and as a result, the appearance of finites out of the infinite. Appearance of finites are occurring in a number of ways. They are occurring by the sedimentation of different attributes of being out of the unitary being. So even within the Vidya, we find that Sat, Chit, Ananda and Vijnana sediment out as different layers or different gradations of being, of consciousness in being. And then we find that the avidya grades out into matter, life and mind. These become primary gradations that are separated from each other, almost like sedimented layers that have clear distinctions between each other. And these distinctions are made, so therefore they are what he calls the sort of bounded infinites. They are bounded infinites and hence they are in a sense finite. They are forms of infinity that are bounded, you see. Now, within that, there are other finites that emerge. They are finites of experience. The finite of experiencing time is through occurrences of phenomena or events such as birth, experience of events and death. See, these caesura or punctuation marks in our experience create finity or finitude. Again, we find another finite existing in our experience of separation of relation in beings, creatures. These are all distinct units that are separated from each other. This is the appearance of the finite, which is also maintained by the will to avidya. That is something that is created out of the vidya. So these basic distinctions are being maintained in a cosmos in which there is a polarity that is created first between spirit and matter. Now, this is what Sri Aurobindo is getting at, and he's trying to get at this, and he's explaining it through the fact that in our phenomenal experience, we find this kind of finite phenomenology in relation to the infinite. And we discover it and take it all the way up from our normal everyday experience through overmind and passing into supermind and the vidya. So this is what he has shown us, and that's where we stand right now, at the borders between overmind and supermind. He has located the origin of the problem that he has set out in this chapter, which is the problem of indeterminates and cosmic determinations. In other words, determinations, what we may call the law of the universe, a certain kind of principle by which order is presented, the order that we just talked about, the principles that maintain this cosmic existence, those determinants are emerging out of something which is indeterminate. So indeterminate, that which cannot be determined, that which is absolute and radically infinite, therefore no law can completely explain it, and the existence of a certain self-presentation of that radical infinity which gives consistency to it, from a plane of immanence to a plane of consistency, is what we see at the borders between overmind and supermind. And these two realities, the indeterminate and the determinable, are coexistent realities at the borders of the overmind. And she has introduced these as Nirguna and Saguna Brahman. Saguna Brahman having form, having order, having relations, generating a cosmos, being present in everything in the cosmos, giving meaning to the cosmos. And Nirguna Brahman as that which negates this entire cosmic reality and takes it beyond into something which is unknown and unknowable. That's the reason why radical infinity presupposes a epistemology that includes the known, the unknown, and the unknowable. So that's how we move, and at the borders of the overmind discover the determinable and the indeterminable side by side. So that's where we were in that last paragraph, which we covered, where he's talking about the fact that both are necessary to our cosmos. Not only is it a cosmos that is marked by the logos, that is the power of the ordering element of the divine, but it is also marked by the freedom of negating the order, the freedom of what is called negative theology. And it's interesting that this you know, is the more, if we look at the history of world cultures, we find that the Eastern traditions have veered towards this negating polarity, moving out of the cosmos by calling it a permanent domain of suffering, and using the power of negative theology of what is called neti-neti, of denying successively whatever is experienced to arrive at something which is incommunicable and unknowable. And on the other hand, we found that the history of Western civilization has focused on establishing what is the power of the ordering mechanism of God, what is the science of the cosmos, and out of that also, what is the science by which we can better and perfect this cosmos. So that is the logos. And of course, the Western tradition has also been critical of its own investment in the logos in contemporary times by calling this move logocentric. Logocentric as a kind of a pejorative term, as a negative term. On the other hand, we've looked at the negative possibilities of negative theology in the sense that it creates a world-negating experience, that we move out of this cosmos into something which is ineffable, but we lose the world. And it's Sri Aurobindo, arising out of the Eastern tradition, is constantly critical of that. We'll find him saying that there is a meaning to the negation, but the negation is not the absolute, and that's why we have to look at both. And there he is really veering very close to the Isha Upanishad, which is talking about how we have to affirm the vidya and the avidya together simultaneously to attain to the goal of life. So that's where we are. I'd like to read from the last paragraph that we finished to bring us back into what we are doing right now, into the present paragraph.
So would you like to start with but neither, or the paragraph earlier at the same time?
No, I'll just read a sentence or two from that previous paragraph, and then we can move into but neither.
Okay.
Yeah. So there he's, that previous paragraph, he's laying out these two, so these two existences, which are also two powers. The existence of Saguna Brahman and Nirguna Brahman, which actually act as two kinds of experiences to the creatures of the cosmos, and two kinds of powers that these creatures can use to arrive at these experiences. So he's saying it is this essential indeterminability of the Absolute that translates itself into our consciousness through the fundamental negating positives of our spiritual experience. Negating positives, in other words, they are positives because they are being used to arrive at an experience, and yet they are negating positives. The immobile, immutable self, the Nirguna Brahman, the eternal without qualities, the pure, featureless one existence, the impersonal, the silence void of activities, the non-being, the ineffable and the unknowable. On the other side, it is the essence and source of all determinations, and the dynamic essentiality manifests to us through the fundamental affirming positives in which the Absolute equally meets us. For it is the Self that becomes all things, the Saguna Brahman, the Eternal with infinite qualities, the One who is the Many, the Infinite Person who is the source and foundation of all persons and personalities, the Lord of creation, the Word, the Master of all works and action. It is that which being known, all is known. These affirmatives correspond to those negatives, for it is not possible in a supramental cognition to split asunder the two sides of the one existence. Even to speak of them as sides is excessive, for they are in each other, their coexistence or one existence is eternal, and their powers sustaining each other found the self-manifestation of the infinite. So,
Devashish?
Yeah.
Can I ask you real quick? Would
Owen.
What would the masculine and would there be? There. When looking at these two kind of paradoxical or possibilities.
Yeah.
Would the masculine and the feminine, does he speak about, or could you just, you know, speak a little bit about the masculine and feminine sides of them? Or if Sri Aurobindo sees the impersonal or the personal as either masculine or feminine?
Actually, that's a little bit of a tough question, because masculine and feminine are polarities just as these are polarities. I think masculine and feminine polarities both belong to the end of the manifestation. But this is a more primal distinction than masculine and feminine. So masculine and feminine are this polarity which carries down throughout the creation. As you know, so it becomes Purusha and Prakriti, for example. But Purusha and Prakriti are both within the manifest, within the Saguna, you see. So you may say the masculine there is the shadow of the Nirguna within the Saguna, you see. So he's talking about the Saguna as the Lord. So when he talks about the Lord, there is also the consort of the Lord, which is the feminine, you see, which in Shaivite traditions is shown as the Ardha Narishwara, that is, the Lord who is half male and half female. You see? So when we use the term masculine and feminine, we are already anthropomorphizing this more primal distinction. And one place the mother says, it's probably better not to talk about masculine and feminine in these absolute terms, because these are conventions. They may be just human conventions that we stuck upon the absolute. See? So this masculine and feminine business is something which, in a sense, can help to some extent, a relative extent, but it's certainly not absolute. All it means is that there are polarities all the way down.
I see. So when Nirguna Brahman, as well as, you're saying, as well as the Saguna Brahman are, it's not helpful to speak about the masculine and the feminine within both of these constructs, or you can within the Saguna Brahman, but farther on down the line.
Yeah. Say, for example, we may say that both of them, we could cut it all three ways. We could say Nirguna Brahman in the conventional sense is more masculine and Saguna Brahman is more feminine. We could say that if we already assume a convention, that there's a very interesting conversation the mother has where she says, we first set the convention of what is masculine and what is feminine, and then we can read all this stuff, but we can reverse the conventions equally. You see, each one of them is both masculine and feminine. Mm-hmm. So, but what is important is that what's being pointed out is that for the manifestation of the ignorance, or for any manifestation, to a certain extent, but particularly for the manifestation of the ignorance, polarities become important. Now, what the distinction I was going to make in that respect is this, that, you know, say we have been talking a little bit about contemporary Western philosophy, and I brought in sometimes Gilles Deleuze, who talks about the plane of immanence, which he's getting in a sense from Spinoza. The Spinozan tradition, speaks about the one, where there is only one. The one that we may translate in the Indian tradition as Brahman. So according to the Spinozan tradition, and Deleuze as well, there is only a plane of immanence. In other words, there is only one, and there are variations within the one. If the one has graded itself, it is all within the one. This is true. So this is one way of looking at reality, which is, you know, a kind of a Brahmic way, a way by utilizing Brahman all the way down. You see, there is only Brahman. But there is another tradition, which is the dialectical tradition. In the Spinozan Deleuzian tradition, there is no dialectics. There are only variations. You see, in dialectics, you have variations that are maintained in their difference through negating wills. In other words, there are very distinct wills that separate things from one another. In the Deleuzian tradition, there are the variations are porous. See? Now you may say the Deleuzian and the Spinozan traditions are true, even in an absolute sense, but they are much more applicable to the Vidya. In the Vidya, the Hegelian sort of dialectical, you know, reality has a truth, and that truth is what maintains these polarities as different. You see, there is a will that maintains them as different. Now, this will can be overcome, but it can only be overcome through the identification with the will that maintains them. So, in a sense, what we find is that Sri Aurobindo is clarifying over here that we have these polarities, and at the origin of these polarities is the distinction between the unknowable and the knowable, In other words, the known and the unknown as one end, and the unknowable as the other end, which mark the radical infinity of being, is necessary to maintain, to have a manifestation within which this kind of gradation occurs and experience occurs along that gradient.
Is this a dialectic then? In this sense,
it is a dialectic. Yes, it is a dialectic, and because it is a dialectic, there are relations that are radically infinite, that are perpetual, that will never end, that will continue manifesting. You see, because it is radically infinite, it maintains its infinity of self-experience through this dialectic.
I see, and so there is, and the two opposing wills, thesis and antithesis, produce a synthesis by interacting.
Exactly. So that is the truth of the avidya. Now, in the vidya, it is not like that. You see. So the point that is being made is not that we are going to jump out of the avidya into the vidya, into the world where there is no dialectical relationship, but that we are going to move to a new definition or new experience of reality in which the Brahmic consciousness or the absolute beyond dialectics coexists with the world of perpetual unfolding due to a dialectical relationship. See, these two coexist. So, what does that mean? We do not really know what that means. We cannot know what that means until we experience it. And to experience it is a different realization of time. It's a completely new experience of time than what we have right now. Our experience of time is already one of those primary distinctions that maintains the avidya as separate from the vidya.
Okay, well, let me just ask you one more thing then. Is the avidya, which to me I'm from a pedestrian level and I need to look it up again, but looking at it from knowledge and kind of that point of knowing that you're talking about, that point of gnosis, and that's it, and I kind of see it like the absolute, but I also see it as kind of the absolute, very, very high level, if you want to categorize it. So does the avidya, does Nirguna Brahman, or how does Nirguna Brahman and Saguna Brahman, how are each of those in avidya, or how would you characterize that?
No, I would say that Nirguna Brahman is the power that takes us beyond avidya and ultimately even beyond vidya. You see, vidya itself is a manifestation or self-presentation of the unknowable. See, and avidya is a self-representation of the unknowable. You see, a self-presentation and a self-representation. So Nirguna Brahman is that which is beyond, partly, say, one foot in Satchidananda and one beyond it, you see. And then Saguna Brahman is the way by which Nirguna Brahman presents itself as Satchidananda first, that as Vidya first, and from Vidya emanates Avidya or manifests Avidya. So Vidya and Avidya are both aspects of Saguna Brahman. Nirguna Brahman is the other side of Saguna Brahman. Both Saguna Brahman and Nirguna Brahman are present in Satchidananda. But how they are present is, that's the point I'm making. How they are present, we cannot know until we have that experience, which is a totally new experience of time.
Okay, and so Avidya is coming from Saguna Brahman, and so it is. I'm going to kind of say it would be more personal and more, perhaps more manifest or more kind of.
Yeah, it is manifest. It is the manifestation.
Okay.
Yes. It is the manifestation that we know. It is the manifestation marked by polarities, marked by distinctions, gradations, and marked by relations.
Wow, yeah, and it sounds like it's marked by the relation between Saguna Brahman and Nirguna Brahman also.
Sort of, yeah, and it's also marked by finitude. It's marked by the appearance of finitude, by appearance of the finite.
Okay. Well, thank you. I think it's interesting to place this within the dialectic and the one.
I think that's a really important distinction, because that's where I think to talk about, you see, that's why, because I've spoken earlier about Deleuze and Spinoza, etc., takes us, it's a very important tool to take us up to a certain distance. But there are certain things that it will not help us with. And the major thing it will not help us with is the reality of the struggle to emerge out of the ignorance into a new experience of reality. So that struggle is real. The struggle is something which is real, because the dialectical difference between the avidya and the vidya are maintained by a will. And that will is the will of the Brahman that allows for a new kind of experience, the experience of the evolution.
Devashish, just one thing I was thinking in this discussion particularly, that is, can we say whether we call it masculine, feminine, or dialectical, or dualities, polarities, whatever, whichever language we use, can we say that that has an inherent assumption? I mean, with that, when we say this is this and that is that, that when we say this is this, meaning this is not that. Say this not that or not this is something that pertains to avidya, because vidya has, like, everything is everything. Sort of, you cannot say this is not that, or this is not masculine, or this is not feminine, or this is not, you know, something. Can we say that vidya necessarily always includes everything? Even if it differentiates, it doesn't exclude.
Yes, absolutely. You can say that. Now, the thing is that's I think that is the very basic fact, that in an absolute sense, there is nothing which is not anything else. So that is, of course, the absolute truth, which pertains to all levels, vidya and avidya. But in the experience of avidya, these distinctions are maintained as almost like given a finite difference, you know, like, and if not a finite, a bounded infinite difference. In other words, that's how they are made distinct from each other. Now, in vidya, also such a thing may exist, but when we say, like you already mentioned, in super, because the origin of these gradations is in supermind. The will that maintains their distinction is arising in supermind. More specifically, it is prajnana of supermind that maintains these distinctions. Now, once it does that inside supermind, it contains both the relative reality of these distinctions and the absolute reality of the negation of all distinctions. These two coexist. That's the point I was making about vidya and avidya coexisting in supermind, which is a different experience of time, a completely different experience of time than what we can even imagine. And we can only know what it is if we experience it. But at our level, there is a different kind of experience, because for us, these distinctions are watertight distinctions. They are maintained by the same will, but the negation of this these distinctions does not coexist with it. It can coexist with it, but as an exclusive reality. That's the point he's making here. Up to the borders of the overmind, the nirguna and the saguna have equal relative existence, but no relation.
Right. So what I mean is that the vidya has may or may not have differentiations, or does include differentiations, but not exclusivity. This exclusivity is nature of avidya.
Yes, exactly.
So when you're talking about the male and the female, is that and you say that that's something that only in the manifestation is, does that distinction already happen in the overmind? Is overmind also already part of the avidya, and so this distinction is there even in the overmind?
So if we are going to talk about male and female, then you see what happens is that we are anthropomorphizing. In other words, already we are saying that there is a person with these kinds of characteristics. And the person with this kind of characteristics is coming down into the creation as the creatures who are sexually differentiated. Now, this kind of differentiation, if we talk about it, we move out of the philosophical realm into the realm of theism, you know, of the person. And now, of course, there is the person element, and Sri Aurobindo strongly affirms the person element, and even this male and female element in terms of the Purusha and the Shakti, or the Ishvara and the Shakti relationship as one of the primary relations within the duality. So this Purusha-Shakti relation, if we want to club it as male and female, of course, that's where the whole thing becomes fuzzy, because as soon as we say male and female, we are talking about something that we are familiar with at our level. But whatever male and female means at that level is not necessarily what we call male and female at our level. We can only have any kind of grasp of it by sort of extrapolating our own experience of male and female into the future of the evolution, where whatever we call male and whatever we call female will have properties which are very different from what they have right now. So the thing is that, you know, whatever we've done so far in our spirituality, even to talk about Shakti, etc., in iconic forms and in various kinds of descriptions, is a very, you know, relative kind of thing. It's not really, you know, what it really is, in other words. So, if we talk about male and female as Ishwara and Shakti or whatever, we are really talking about being and its manifesting power. The importance of that, again, is the world of relations. And in the world of relations, what occurs is that, I mean, if we move from the Nirguna to the Saguna, or the Nirguna and the Saguna as the primary duality, then we move into the duality within the Saguna, which is really a duality of being and its self, its reflexive nature, being and its self-regard. In other words, if Brahman, if Ishwara were to look at itself, this is the reason why in the Ardhanarishwara image, half of Shiva is female and looks at herself with a mirror. It's, you'll always find this in the iconography, that the female part holds a mirror to itself. This use of the mirror to look at oneself causes a certain representation of oneself to take place. And that representation is an evolutionary representation. It is as if a part of oneself has turned round and asked the question, who am I? That asker of the question is the female. And the one of whom it is asked is the male. This is a convention only. And this convention goes down and we look at it in a certain form within the biological world. But in, within the philosophical world, it's really a convention of a relation that to which we give this name.
Okay. Hello? There was the idea?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, so then it becomes, okay. So on a similar vein, is it possible to relate the classification we have of Nirguna, Saguna, along the classification we have of Overmind, the gradations like Overmind, Supermind, or are they all complete in themselves and they don't have corollaries in each other, or like correspondence in each other?
No, certainly we can relate. That's the reason why he's taking these relations all the way up to the borders of the Overmind. And he's saying that in Overmind, we can see that Nirguna and Saguna Brahman are two descriptions of reality that are relative and coexistent and exclusive. But once we go beyond that into Supermind, we find that Nirguna and Saguna Brahman are two sides of the same reality, which is Brahman. They compose the radical infinity of Brahman when it comes into manifestation. We wouldn't even talk of Nirguna and Saguna if there were no need for manifestation. Already in Sachidananda, there is Nirguna and Saguna that coexist in a certain experience, which, as I said, is beyond our knowledge. But beyond, say, you know, in the book, The Philosophy of the Upanishads, Sri Aurobindo points out how the avyakta paratpara, what is called the supreme beyond the beyond, is something which is the component of radical infinity that even goes beyond the Sachidananda. But that is something which presents itself as Sachidananda. And as soon as it presents itself, manifestation begins. As soon as manifestation begins, Nirguna and Saguna coexist, because to any manifestation there must be an infinite remainder. That infinite remainder, which marks the infinity of radical infinity, is something which, you know, is in dialectical relationship with any other order of infinity, even a infinity of Sachidananda.
Devashish?
Yes.
This characterization seems to fall right within the tradition of Advaita Vedanta and true Advaita Vedanta, the Advaita Vedanta of Ramakrishna, of Ramana Maharshi, but also going back to going all the way back. But and then today you kind of also have this kind of a lot of neo Advaita non-dualistic schools that have arisen, and they kind of just posit that everything is just one and we're all there already and you don't really have to do anything. But the real Advaita Vedanta non-dualism it seems like this falls within that school, but Sri Aurobindo has brought to the surface more, or described more, or experienced more, perhaps, obviously, that would be implicit within this, more of this tradition that Ramakrishna and I think it's going back to Chaitanya who wrote all of these
original. Owen, yeah. Let me interrupt you. You need to read up a little bit. Neither Ramakrishna nor Ramana Maharshi have anything to say about these things, and Chaitanya is totally different from all this. So, maybe you and I can talk at some time, but this is not coming out of the tradition of Advaita Vedanta. It is perhaps closer to something like Kashmir Shaivism, but there are big distinctions. This is not Advaita Vedanta by a long stretch.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yes. Okay. In fact, the subtext of these paragraphs is actually very closely following the arguments of Advaita Vedanta and pointing out where they go wrong. And the Advaita Vedanta does not make this distinction between... the point that he's making is that Saguna is equal to Nirguna. The Advaita Vedanta privileges Nirguna over Saguna. That distinction he is unwilling to make. Not unwilling, right. He completely does not make.
Right, but I thought that Ramakrishna ultimately privileged Nirguna Brahman, but he... But he believed that...
Ramakrishna, you may say, had these experiences, but Ramakrishna does not philosophize. He does not lay out an order. You see, that's where things are very different. The one who lays out the order is Vivekananda. And Vivekananda's order is very different from what Sri Aurobindo is talking about here. Though there are contradictions within Vivekananda's philosophy that may be read creatively, to point to some of the things that Sri Aurobindo is saying.
Yeah, okay. All right, I appreciate that. Yeah, I see what you're saying now. Good point. Good, mm-hmm. Good, good.
John Robert, would you like to read?
So we're starting with the neither is a separate cognition. Is that where we are?
Yes, that's where we go. That's the title of the one.
Okay. But neither is the separate cognition of them entirely an illusion or a complete error of the ignorance. This too has its validity for spiritual experience. For these primary aspects of the Absolute are fundamental spiritual determinants or indeterminants answering at this spiritual end or beginning to the general determinants or generic indeterminants of the material end or inconscient beginning of the descending and ascending manifestation. Those that seem to us negative carry in them the freedom of the infinite from limitation by its own determinations. Their realization disengages the spirit within, liberates us, and enables us to participate in this supremacy. Thus, when once we pass into or through the experience of immutable self, we are no longer bound and limited in the inner status of our being by the determinations and creations of nature. On the other, the dynamic side, this original freedom enables the consciousness to create a world of determinations without being bound by it. It enables it also to withdraw from what it has created and recreate in a higher truth formula. It is on this freedom that is based the spirit's power of infinite variation of the truth possibilities of existence, and also its capacity to create, without tying itself to its workings, any and every form of necessity or system of order. The individual being, too, by experience of these negating absolutes, can participate in that dynamic liberty, can pass from one order of self-formulation to a higher order. At the stage when, from the mental, it has to move towards its supramental status, one most liberatingly helpful, if not indispensable, experience that may intervene is the entry into a total nirvana of mentality and mental ego, a passage into the silence of the spirit. In any case, a realization of the pure self must always precede the transition to that mediating eminence of the consciousness from which a clear vision of the ascending and descending stairs of manifested existence is commanded, and the possession of the free power of ascent and descent becomes a spiritual prerogative. An independent completeness of identity with each of the primal aspects and powers, not narrowing, as in the mind, into a soul engrossing experience seeming to be final and integral, that would be incompatible with the realization of the unity of all aspects and powers of existence, is a capacity inherent in consciousness in the infinite. That indeed is the base and justification of the overmind cognition and its will to carry each aspect, each power, each possibility to its independent fullness. But the supermind keeps always and in every status or condition the spiritual realization of the unity of all. The intimate presence of that unity is there given even within the completest grasp of each thing, each state given its whole delight of itself, power, and value. There is thus no losing sight of the affirmative aspects, even when there is the full acceptance of the truth of the negative. The overmind keeps still the sense of this underlying unity. That is, for it, the secure base of the independent experience. In mind, the knowledge of the unity of all aspects is lost on the surface. The consciousness is plunged into engrossing, exclusive, separate affirmations. But there too, even in the mind's ignorance, the total reality still remains behind the exclusive absorption and can be recovered in the form of a profound mental intuition or else in the idea or sentiment of an underlying truth of integral oneness. In the spiritual mind, this can develop into an ever-present experience.
So again, this is a very powerful paragraph. I think we started reading it last time and we couldn't talk about it because it's so potent and so pregnant, full of infinities, one may say. So here basic Sri Aurobindo starts by telling us what is the truth of these separate existences. He's saying that he's not telling us that these relative infinities of Nirguna and Saguna Brahman in the overmind need to be overpassed in some reconciling unity which erases them, which rubs them out, or that these are some kind of mistake, they are an error, even the perception is some sort of error. He's saying there is a reason for it, not only a reason which is temporary, but a reason which is a reason within God, a reason which has a real existence. And that is what we, in a sense, just discussed, which is that these two powers are necessary to be sort of looked at as distinct realities, distinct self-presentations of reality, so that a certain kind of experience may arise within being. Now, this experience, you may say, is permanent. We experience it as temporal because we are evolutionary creatures. But within being, all these various layers and levels, going from the unknowable into the Satchidananda or the Vidya and all the ranges of the Avidya, are permanently maintained in a kind of as a form of reality. You see, now when I say as a form of reality, this is the form of reality that Sri Aurobindo is describing as what we experience and as the ladder that he talks about, the ladder of ascent and descent. This ladder of ascent and descent is the order of the supermind, the order by which supermind, as the knowledge organ of Brahman, perceives Brahman as an ordered reality, infinite ordered reality. See, gives order to that which is completely without order, beyond order, we may say. So for that purpose, it is necessary. It is necessary to maintain within the avidya and within the vidya, though the modalities of maintenance within these two are different. So the key, another key sentence in this paragraph is where he says, an independent completeness of identity with each of the primal aspects and powers, not narrowing as in the mind into a soul engrossing experience, seeming to be final and integral, for that would be incompatible with the realization of the unity of all aspects and powers of existence, is a capacity inherent in consciousness in the infinite. So what that means, in a way, is that each of these, well, Saguna Brahman, for example, Nirguna Brahman, for example, Ishvara, Shakti, all these different ways of naming that reality, Brahman, each of these is an infinite. Each of these is one self-presentation of that which is beyond all names and forms. And that self-presentation, that it's not a representation, it's a self-presentation, is an infinite. It's the entire infinity. And hence, each way of looking at these could be taken to be an exclusive reality that is the goal of all realization. But what Sri Aurobindo is saying is the capacity to experience each of them separately and to hold them all together, to know them each to be a self-presentation in the infinite gamut of self-presentations through which the infinite presents itself is a power inherent in chit, in consciousness. And that is the other experience that we are being invited to experience. That is the transition from, not from avidya into the Sachidananda of vidya, but from avidya into the vijnana of avidya, of vidya. In other words, that is the supramental experience. So that's why this entire paragraph is really talking about how there is a need for these distinctions, and at the same time these distinct self-presentations of the infinite, and at the same time for all of them to be experienced at once. So he points out that there is a need for them because they maintain the ladder of ascent and descent. See, that they correspond at the heights to what is at the bottom. From matter to spirit, you have these determinates and the indeterminable, which are in relation, and through that relation maintain the gradations of the ladder of existence. And then he points out how each of these, the soul can ascend and descend this ladder using these two powers. And it's very interesting that we have a number of even folk mythologies that have this kind of distinction that is mentioned in some way or the other. As for example, in Bengal there is a story which is similar to the story of Savitri, in which a certain lady takes her dead husband to get his life back, and in the process she goes to a certain, it's a story, so there are events in it, and she goes through a river and goes to meet a washerwoman, and the name of the washerwoman is Neti. So Neti, as a washerwoman who washes clothes, is exactly a kind of a covert symbol for this power of negation, for the negative absolute, for the power of negative theology to be a purifying force, that it purifies, that it undoes the relations that hold together an exclusivity of a certain order of being. And once it is undone, one can have then another order of being. So the coexistence of these orders of infinity depend on the simultaneous experience of this kind of a freedom, and at the same time the ability to put together different relations to create a different self-presentation of infinity. So that's the point he's making over here, and he's pointing to this as a way by which we can undertake our own journey. And he points to this transition between the vidya and the avidya in that line, which actually refers to his own personal experience, where he says, at the stage when from the mental it has to move towards its supramental status, one most liberatingly helpful, if not indispensable, experience that may intervene is the entry into a total nirvana of mentality and mental ego, a passage into the silence of the spirit. This is what happened to Sri Aurobindo himself, but as we know, he didn't take it as a goal or as a final experience, but as a stage through which a new order could arrive. And that's what he means when he's saying, those that seem to us negative carry in them the freedom of the infinite from limitation by its own determinations. Their realization disengages the spirit within, liberates us, and enables us to participate in the supremacy, Thus, when once we pass into or through the experience of immutable self, we are no longer bound and limited in the inner status of our being, but the determinations and creations of nature. And then he says, it enables us. So the other side, the dynamic side, this original freedom enables the consciousness to create a world of determinations without being bound by it. It enables us to withdraw from it, what it has created, and recreate in a higher truth formula. And this is exactly the knowledge project of Sri Aurobindo, which is to recreate the cosmos in a new truth formula, the formula of supermind.
Devashish, when I read this before and when I read it today, the second sentence in this paragraph is just beyond me. Can you elucidate that?
Yeah, what he's saying, that second sentence, for these primary aspects of the Absolute, which primary aspects of the Saguna and Nirguna Brahman, the two infinites, are fundamental spiritual determinates or indeterminates. So spiritual determinates or indeterminates in the sense that the spiritual determinate is that which gives relations and has order to it, as the Saguna Brahman does, or indeterminates in the sense that it withdraws all these forms of relations and creates something which cannot be given any name, that as the Nirguna Brahman does. Our fundamental spiritual determinates or indeterminates answering at this spiritual end or beginning, so because he's in the previous paragraph talking about these existing in the overmind, which is the spiritual beginning, and it's the end looked at from the sort of material end of things. It is the spiritual end, and from the spiritual side, it is the spiritual beginning. So it answers at that particular point to the general determinates or generic indeterminates of the material end or inconscient beginning. So these two existing at the level of spirit in the overmind and ultimately in the supermind, they answer, in other words, they correspond, they come in a sense into contact with, or they have a lineage to the same two at the material end. At the material end also there is Nirguna and Saguna Brahman, inconscient beginning of the descending and ascending manifestation. And that's the reason why we have a descending and ascending manifestation, because the freedom from each particular self-presentation of infinity in a form of consciousness, the infinity of matter, the infinity of life, the infinity of mind, etc., is maintained by the relationship between Saguna and Nirguna Brahman, which exists at the summits and at the base, and responds or answers to each level through their relation. The Nirguna undoing the knot of each of these worlds, and the Saguna manifesting each of these worlds. Hence, the freedom is maintained, and yet there is a certain graded self-manifestation occurring throughout the gamut of infinite being.
Okay, thank you. I think I got it.
Then,
Devashish?
Yeah.
Back to the sentence, in any case, a realization of the pure self must always precede the transition to that mediating immanence. And speaking about the ascent and the descent, you mentioned the soul, in this sentence,
Let me. Can you find the sentence? I'm trying to find that sentence.
It's in any case a realization of the pure self. It's just above that sentence you started with, an independent completeness of identity.
Okay.
Each of the primal
aspects. Get it. Yeah. In any case, a realization of the pure self must always precede the transition to that mediating eminence from which a clear vision of ascending and descending stairs of manifested existence is coming. Yeah. Tell me what.
Yeah, I'm wondering what the relationship is, either direct to the pure self with the soul. Is the soul the pure self, or, you know, how would you characterize the relationship here with the soul and the pure self and the descending stairs and the knowledge of this that the Sri Aurobindo went through?
Yeah, good question. So the realization of the pure self that he's talking about over here is that, you know, he's using the word pure self more as equated to Nirguna Brahman. You see, pure meaning pure of all relations, that which has no relations, that which is absolutely, you know, without relations, purity in that sense, you see, in the philosophical sense. And so contact with the freedom of that, which is also called in sometimes the unborn self by Sri Aurobindo. So when we are talking about soul, you use the term soul. The soul is also a complex entity. The soul has got on the one side it has the saguna, and actually the soul, you may say, is complex in a number of ways. You can look at the soul like this, Owen. On the one side, at the individual level, there is the evolving soul, which is what Sri Aurobindo and the mother call the psychic being. The psychic being itself is actually a self-formulation of the relationship, because everything at a certain point is a trinity. So the psychic being is a relationship between the Ishvara and the Shakti of Saguna Brahman dwelling within each person. So it is the immanent antar-atman, as they say, the internal, you know, presence of the Ishvara and the Shakti within each individual, and their relation forming a personality which we call the psychic being. Now behind this relationship of the Ishvara and the Shakti is the Nirguna self, the self without any form, but which is what the Gita calls the unborn self within. See, that which can take whatever form it wants. So ultimately the psychic being itself is a dynamic relation which is constantly renewing itself through its contact with the unborn self, or what he's calling the pure self over here. So a realization of the pure self must always precede the transition to that mediating eminence of the consciousness from which a clear vision of the ascending and descending stairs of manifested existence is commanded. So mediating eminence of consciousness, which is basically, he's talking about this ability to mediate between the levels. And how does one mediate between the levels? One mediates only by being able to undo and do in a kind of a virtual sense. You see, one is not really undoing anything, but one has the ability to undo by contact with the pure self. One is free of every determination, in other words. It's that freedom from every determination that allows the ascent and descent along the ladder of existence, which is the prerogative of supramental existence. Underneath that, there is either an exclusive experience or a relative experience. An exclusive experience which rubs out everything else, or an experience from level to level. Now, you mentioned Ramakrishna, Owen, and I do believe that Ramakrishna had many of these experiences and has talked about them in mystic ways that have not really been understood. And one of those ways is he's actually literally referred to the ladder of existence. And he's talked about the fact that there is a ladder that runs up and down the spine of being. Brahman itself is a ladder, and he says that normally human beings climb up that ladder with difficulty from rung to rung and climb only up that ladder. But he says there are those human beings he calls Jiva Koti. But he says there is another class of beings that are called Ishwara Koti. They dwell in the house of the Lord, in other words. They have another kind of existence in which they can climb up and down that ladder at will. Now this is what he's talking about here. And what Ramakrishna therefore means by Ishwara Koti is the supramental existence. It is only in the supramental existence that one might climb up and down at will, because one has the full freedom throughout that entire manifestation. One commands that eminence, as he says, the mediating eminence of the consciousness, the free power of ascent and descent.
Yeah, I'll have to send it to you later, but it was mostly in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. It was the long introduction that was done by, I can't remember his name, but where he discusses the philosophy of, that's always been a primary go-to place for me for the philosophy of this, but I just need to look at it more closely in terms of what we're discussing here, and then perhaps go over some of that with you.
Yeah, that'll be good. I think maybe you're talking about Nikhilananda. I'm not sure. Yeah, but you see, it would be good to go over it, because what happens with these people who've done the philosophy of Sri Ramakrishna is that they select, and they create a selective philosophy and leave out all these more mystic things, or assimilate them to their Advaita Vedanta. But these are completely outside of Advaita Vedanta, actually.
Right. Let me just, on that sentence that we're on, it sounds to me that the realization of the pure self,
I think Joanna has her mic on. If she would turn it off, the echo would go off.
Oh, I'm sorry. I had a question, so I'll turn it off.
Yeah, turn it off for now, and then sure, be happy to answer your question. Yeah, Owen. Yes, Owen.
Just to conclude, it seems that a realization of the pure self was a pivotal kind of and an important step to the which is the nirguna, the indifferentiated absolute without relationship realm was a pretty pure pretty important step in terms of recognizing the descent and the ascent of the soul or the psychic being. And I would also just say that there's an interesting parallel. I would just kind of put that out there of, it could mean different things, but of Jacob's ladder, where you see
yes.
the ascent and the descent.
I agree.
And I wanted to put that out there as well.
Yes. Good. True. Joanna, you had a question? Or a comment?
Yes, I did. In that same paragraph, like about three sentences before the one we were just looking at, there's something that kind of stymies me. Maybe you can help with it. It's the sentence that starts, it says, on the other, the dynamic side, this original freedom enables the consciousness to create a world of determinations without being bound. And then it says, it enables it also to withdraw from what it has created and recreate in a higher truth formula. And there's too many it's there. I don't know what the it's are referring to. I got confused.
Okay. Okay, so here what he's talking about is that the it's okay. This original freedom is the freedom of the Nirguna Brahman. And the consciousness to create a world of determination. So the consciousness over here, and mark that he spells the consciousness with a capital C, with an uppercase C. And he means there that he means the chit shakti. In other words, he's saying that if we can undo our attachment to a certain order of things through the Nirguna Brahman, then the consciousness recreates a new order and is enabled to recreate a new order in a new formula. You see? So the consciousness to create a world of determinations without being bound by it, in other words, without being bound by the world of determinations. You see? So the consciousness is free from any determination it creates because it has the power of the Nirguna Brahman. That's what that part means. It enables it also, it meaning the experience of the Nirguna Brahman, enables it, meaning the consciousness, also to withdraw from what it has created, from what consciousness has created, and recreate in a higher truth formula. In other words, the freedom of consciousness to move from whatever it has created to and uncreate it and recreate it exists because of the experience of Nirguna Brahman. This is what he's saying.
Thank you. That helps a lot.
Okay. So also important in this, very important in this paragraph is that distinction that we discussed a little earlier about how there is a difference in the way in which these distinctions are maintained, these different infinities are maintained as exclusives or as coexisting realities within a greater consciousness, depending on whether we are in avidya or vidya. And Sri Aurobindo makes this distinction in terms of three realities, supermind, overmind, and mind. And so for the we may translate avidya into the mind existence, we may translate vidya into the supermind existence of a certain kind, of the supramental kind, and we may translate overmind as the mediating experience between supermind and mind, or between avidya and vidya. So he says, but the supermind keeps always and in every status or condition the spiritual realization of the unity of all. That's that the ability to know the different self-presentations. So it's as if it has the command over the entire ladder, all at once, and over each of its rungs. The intimate presence of that unity is there even within the completest grasp of each thing. In other words, it can enter into every one of these self-presentations and be it and act from it, and at the same time be free and present in other each one of its other existences. Each state given its whole delight of itself, power, and value. There is thus no losing sight of the affirmative aspects, even when there is the full acceptance of the truth of the negative. It's free and it is bound, both at the same. It binds itself, rather, or it creates its own sense of binding. If we look, call it that, binding being more the world of relations, binding taken more like a friendship, the way in which things befriend each other in relation, that as well as the freedom from that are both at the same time. Now he moves to the overmind. The overmind keeps still the sense of this underlying unity. That's important, the use of the word sense. In other words, in overmind there begins the distinction between these as watertight realities, but there is an underlying sense that they are the same. See that just as we have an intuition of sense, we can overpass our distinct physical existences between person and person through a kind of internal sense, a sympathy, you may say, that gives us a greater sense of unity. So here, overmind keeps the sense of this underlying unity. That is for it the secure base of the independent existence. So there are independent exclusive existences, but there is a secure base to it. That base attenuates through the descending ladder from overmind through the mind, life, and material existences. In mind, which he puts with a capital M, because in a sense the whole of the avidya may be thought of as part of the mind, the knowledge of the unity of all aspects is lost on the surface. The consciousness is plunged into engrossing exclusive separate affirmations. The distinction between overmind and mind is an important one, because overmind is cosmic consciousness. It's as if the mind became global. It's as if one mind thought of the vast ideas that include all other ideas. See, that's the nature of over-mental thinking. It thinks everything in one flash. So in that place, we now have in mind fragmented ideas. And the more fragmented they are, the more separate they are. We are engrossed in each one of them. We are trapped in each one of them. But there too, even in the mind's ignorance, the total reality still remains behind the exclusive absorption and can be recovered in the form of a profound mental intuition. This is something that relates to the distinction Sri Aurobindo makes between the external mind and what he calls the inner mind. The inner mind plane or the inner mind existence has a subtler experience of the unity behind things, and can actually, that the people who have a greater access to the inner mind also can create new languages through which they can talk about subtler unities that bridge these exclusive distinctions that the logical mind makes. Poets, for example, have that power. Or else in the idea or sentiment of an underlying truth of integral oneness. In the spiritual mind, this can develop into an ever-present experience. So even in these two sentences, he's pointing to a way. He's saying that in our normal experience, we are trapped in this kind of exclusivity of each one of these ideas of reality or of the divine. But that if we were to turn a little bit within, we'll find that the inner mind intuits and a oneness behind these distinctions. So it can maintain the distinctions and also treat them more flexibly. Then we can enlarge the scope of the mental experience into a more cosmic experience in which there is what he says, the spiritual mind, an ever-present experience. So that the sense of the overmind, of the one being in many different self-presentations, can begin to emerge within the inner mind itself as the mental activity ascends. And then ultimately, one can cross the boundaries and have the supramental experience. So it's an interesting last few lines in which he's pointing to a kind of path for the development of mental consciousness towards an experience that will be more compatible with what the goal of this journey is. In another way, this is related to what he talks about in the synthesis of yoga as building an intuitive mentality. This is another formulation of that we can build that intuitive mentality from where we are by turning into the inner mind and affirming the kind of intuition of the oneness that we experience at that level. Uh, Shyam, I think it's almost time to leave. I mean, it's almost the end right now, but I see a message from Jyoti saying that she would like to join. But I think it's a, you could let her know that it's time to finish up or whatever. This is Jyoti from England.
Okay.
You see a message? Do you see a message? There's a kind of a text message over there.
No, I don't. Maybe I'm...
maybe.
I don't, but we'll figure that out offline.
Yeah,
that's
okay.
Already, yeah, I'll speak to her or something.
Okay.
It's already 9:30, so do we want to stop here and continue next time?
Yeah, we could do that, or we could do what you've been doing, that is, read the next paragraph and...
I think paragraph two, so perhaps we can read that and then stop. It'll give us something to...
set our goals on, yeah.
Yeah.
When is the next session?
I think the email went out. The next session will be 2 weeks from now.
It's usually the second and the fourth Saturdays.
So this time also it will be around the same time. It will be the 15th and the 29th, which usually is around the time of the second and fourth. So because this month has an extra week, so we are having it today. But the next one will be 15th November.
Thanks.
Yeah, if you're not on the mailing list, you can message me, and I think one of us can add you to the group.
How do I message you?
Just send it to me on Skype or email or something. Skype is good, yeah.
What's your email?
Yeah, let me call you after this, and we can discuss that. Margaret, would you like to read the last paragraph before we stop for today?
Yes, and that starts with all aspects?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. All aspects of the omnipresent reality have their fundamental truth in the supreme existence. Thus, even the aspect or power of unconscience, which seems to be an opposite, a negation of the eternal reality, yet corresponds to a truth held in itself by the self-aware and all-conscious infinite. It is, when we look closely at it, the infinite's power of plunging the consciousness into a trance of self-involution, a self-oblivion of the spirit veiled in its own abysses, where nothing is manifest, but all inconceivably is and can emerge from that ineffable latency. In the heights of spirit, this state of cosmic or infinite trance sleep appears to our cognition as a luminous, uttermost superconscious. At the other end of being, it offers itself to cognition as the spirit's potency of presenting to itself the opposites of its own truths of being, an abyss of non-existence, a profound night of inconscience, a fathomless swoon of insensibility from which yet all forms of being, consciousness and delight of existence can manifest themselves. But they appear in limited terms, in slowly emerging and increasing self-formulations, even in contrary terms of themselves. It is the play of a secret all-being, all delight, all knowledge, but it observes the rules of its own self-oblivion, self-opposition, self-limitation, until it is ready to surpass it. This is the inconscience and ignorance that we see at work in the material universe. It is not a denial. It is one term, one formula of the infinite and eternal existence.
So we'll stop at this point and continue two Saturdays from now. Thank you, everybody. And Joanna, I'll call you right after this to figure out how to add you to the mailing list.
Thank you.
Thank you for helping me be able to understand the paragraph I read.
Thank you, everybody.
Okay. Thank you, Debashish.
Okay, thanks. And see you on the 15th.